In this lecture, I'd like to describe some of the ideas we've been working on in regards to the possibility that the mind may have a fundamental role to play in connection with the construction of reality.
So there have been various meetings to see what ideas people have got. There's actually a book that's come out with three of these conferences, but if you're interested, there's this website inbioza.eu which has position paper. It's a committee effort. Lots of people throwing out ideas of how this problem could be solved, and also a PowerPoint thing. Okay, but to get to my own approach now, you could put it as this question: what grounds physics? And there are two possibilities, the traditional one being something mathematical, and the newer one something to do with computation or machine or mind. So let me go through these. Well, this all started off with a very important person at Trinity, Isaac Newton. He wrote down equations for Newtonian mechanics. These fitted very well to the phenomena like planetary orbits. So it's become a model for physics. After that, one further triumph is Maxwell's equations, which did the same for electromagnetism, just four simple equations, which describe the phenomenon of electromagnetism. Well, that wasn't quite enough. There was relativity made things a bit complicated, except Maxwell's equations already worked with relativity. But then there's quantum theory, and then things started to get complicated, but the average person wouldn't have enough mathematics to understand it. But quantum theory then described things like atoms. You could solve, well, you could do chemistry with it, you could grind calculations, and you would get atoms and molecules that explained it all, a chemical bond. Well, then things, of course, had to get a little more difficult. There was a many-body problem, and then there was quantum electrodynamics, the next most complicated theory and more difficult mathematics. That didn't work for all the particles. It only encompassed the common or garden particles. So there were things like mesons and baryons and so on, and strange particles. But then something called the Standard Model came to the rescue. The same sort of thing, but more elaborate, with about 20 parameters, lots of fields. But that explained all the particles quite well. But then there's a little problem. There was a nice theory of gravity, Einstein's general theory of relativity. So then, having unified the three other forces, the weak, strong force, and electromagnetic forces, they tied those all together with much effort and lots of Nobel Prizes coming out. The next thing was, well, obviously, adding gravity, and then encountered problems because gravity didn't join in any simple way. However, the mathematicians got their heads together, came up with supersymmetry, and you could, well, get gravity out of that, but the problem, you have to add extra dimensions, 10 or 11 or something, and that was when it started to turn from physics into mathematics, because for a start, we don't see these extra dimensions, but there's a trick for getting rid of them, but still they're unphysical. And further problems, they'd hoped that this would be the theory of everything, one theory which would explain everything, but unfortunately the trick for getting rid of the extra dimensions could be done in, I think, 10 to 520 different ways. So that's a bit of an embarrassment. It was more complicated than a Standard Model. It became pure mathematics, elegant mathematics, and you might say dreaming, because it no longer had any connection with the real world. Of course, people hope that there's a real world, but nothing's been found that fits the theory specifically. So, Rosetta and...
okay, well, so happened that in, I think it was 1976, I shared an office when I was visiting MIT with someone called Ed Fredkin, and he was working on something to explain the universe in terms of bits. I'm not sure the precise model, but this is something, probably the cellular automaton. Anyway, he was trying to persuade people that this was a good model of reality. It's just, well, you've probably all heard of Conway's life game, which is an example of this. You have a lattice and you have rules which say how it evolves. So it's a kind of computation. Let me say that there are really two strands. There's the formal models like the cellular automata, or they're more biological models. Now I'll go into each of these in some detail in the next slide. There are various names. Wolfram is the person who's best known because of his book, New Science of New Kind of Science, I think it's called. Okay, well, let me now follow up this direction. Just say that there's these two differences, things which are more mechanical and things which are more biological. Okay, well, what's the point about the cellular automata? Well, people found when you run this model, interesting things happen. The idea was that these interesting things might account for the strange behavior in quantum mechanics. This is what you could call emergent behavior. New things emerge from old. And so that was one reason why people were interested in them. Another thing, I think... Wolfram did a lot of work adjusting all sorts of rules, and he found some rules had rather interesting behaviour, and instead of rather simple behaviour, repetitive, he found in a certain range you got complex behaviour. And one thing people found is that out of these models you could construct something called the universal Turing machine, and the universal Turing machine something that can do any calculation. This was Turing's great contribution to computation, or should I say one of his great contributions. Turing wanted to pin down what actually a well-defined calculation was, and he said it's composed of these things, and he furthermore found you could define a set of rules, this universal Turing machine, which could do any calculation of a certain kind. Of course, the modern computer can do that, but this was the most basic form. It had a system which changed according to certain rules, and it had a tape it could write on, and that could do anything. So, anyway, these cellular automata, because you could build a universal Turing machine from them, could do any calculation, which is sort of an impressive thing. Okay, but I haven't got... Well, that far, I don't think, and people are still thinking about what they can do. But I'm more interested in the more biological strand. And story as far as I'm concerned. Well, David Bohm did some interesting things, but Wheeler did the interesting things. There's an amazing article he wrote called Law Without Law, which you can find if you search on that, and a few other things, the idea of it from bit. But anyway, perhaps I could give you some quotes from him. Recent decades have taught us that physics is a magic window. He's very poetic. It shows us that the illusion that lies behind reality and the reality that lies behind illusion. Sorry, it shows us the illusion that lies behind reality and the reality that lies behind it, illusion. Its scope is immensely greater than we once realized. We are no longer satisfied with insights only into particles or fields of force or geometry or even space and time. He worked on activity in space and time, theories where you didn't have a fixed space and time, but there were things like wormholes, so he was interested in space-time as a physical thing. Anyway, today we might demand of physics some understanding of existence himself. Well, probably not many physicists would get to that level, but that was something that Wheeler was interested in. In fact, he said, this is the thing I want to sort out at the end of my life, this problem. Okay, another quote. If the views we're exploring here, which I'll say something about in a moment, are correct, one principle, observer participancy, suffices to build everything. Well, okay, well, what did Wheeler have in mind? Well, in quantum mechanics, there's a thing called wave function collapse. And a simple illustration of this is you have a source, you have waves coming out of it. You also have a detector. Now, the funny thing about the quantum world is that things sometimes behave like waves and sometimes like particles. And this source produces something which acts like a wave because you can do interference experiments with it and so on. On the other hand, a detector will register all the energy focused on a point, which is something strange. If the thing can go on past the detector and it's not absorbed by it, it then its position has been observed and you can then pick it up on its trajectory. Okay, so okay, we have this collapse, but the thing is, different observations collapse in different ways. If you observe something different, you have a different kind of collapse. This is not airy-fairy philosophy. There's a very definite equations for it, and it fits the experiment. So it's the world acts as if we make an observation, and then this collapse thing occurs. So his idea behind law without law is that if you observed in the right way, you might even be able to create universes and affect the laws of the universe. So this, I think, was basically speculation. But he had the idea that after a big bang, there'd be a very vague universe, which is the kind of thing in quantum mechanics. Lots of things there at once. And then life would appear, and it would start observing, and it would start shaping reality till you've got the kind of universe we've got now. But he didn't really have much to say about much idea as to how that would actually happen. There was no mathematics there. So if you want this observer participancy process, it's participancy because you don't just observe as in classical mechanics, you do something when you observe. You are a participator in creating reality. You would need some kind of organized process, really, if you wanted to build a universe. Well, then, various people have got ideas on this. Hameroff and Penrose wanted to... they're actually interested in what consciousness did. Hameroff is an anesthesiologist, so naturally he's interested in consciousness, since his job is getting rid of it and bringing it back again afterwards. Penrose is a physicist who's trying to fix some problems. Well, their idea, let me quote, a network of microtubules, those are things in the brain which they thought might act as a computer, can tune itself appropriately to achieve control of its own state of superposition and reduction. Again, this was somewhat nebulous. Henry Stapp, on the other hand, was interested in how the mind would fit into physics. And he had some interesting things. His idea essentially was that you can't fit this observation process into physics. It would be something external. And the mind sort of was something extra which grasped reality and made decisions. In fact, let me have a quote. This is typically involved language of Henry Stapp, who is a very precise sort of person. He tries to be completely rigorous. The conscious act is represented physically by the selection of new top-down, top-level code, which then automatically exercises top-level control over the flow of neural excitations in the brain through the action of the quantum theoretic laws of nature. The unity of conscious thought comes from the unifying integrative character of the conscious creative act, which selects a single code from among the multitude generated by the causal development prescribed by quantum theory. Okay, but how does it happen?
I don't think he has equations for that, especially since mind, he said mind wasn't included in quantum theory, so he was just invoking, postulating the mind acted in a certain way.
Well, one of the things I've been interested in since the 70s is mind-matter unification. I might just give my motivation for this.
But I've been involved with a lot of somewhat heretical things in which it seems mind plays a more important part than is allowed for in physics. One of these is Eastern philosophy, and I mentioned the book of Kapfer, which was one of my introductions to it. It's paranormal phenomena, which seem to be pretty well proved by experiments. You might be interested to look on the university media site for a talk that Rupert Sheldrake gave in the Winstanley lecture room, where he described his experiments on telephone telegraphy. Well, that suggests minds can do interesting things. I collaborated with musicologist in Trinity about the nature of music, why music has these very specific structures. Again, that pointed to something beyond what we know at this time.
Okay. So,
but more recently, as I said, I've been involved with a collaboration involving someone called Alexa Yardley, who contacted me with an idea called circular theory, and we've been collaborating on this. You might say that she's Jung and I'm Pauli. She's the mystic and I'm a scientist. And Jung and Pauli try to connect their ideas. Pretty well the same thing's been happening in this case. So let me... this book, you can get circular theory on the web. I'm not sure how... You might have a problem understanding it, but perhaps you'll be a little more comprehensible after this talk. I don't know. But anyway... I've produced my own take on it, and I'm going to describe it in terms which I think are reasonably okay with science.
Now, so the theory involves two main ideas.
Critical grouping, that's sort of essentially saying the same thing as circular theory.
Templates, which is
I think is behind a lot of her thinking, is my own way of describing it. So, what is critical grouping?
Well,
a critical point is a point of balance. It's a thing that happens, say, when you go from a non-magnetic to a magnetic state and things start to become unstable and move. There's lots of variability and uncertainty in the critical state. And grouping is, well, ordinary grouping, things coming together into groups and coming apart. So the idea is that things can fairly easily move, join together or come apart. Now, groups are interesting. They occur in various places in physics. One thing is networks. You make a network out of a group of things which work together to produce an interesting result. Computer programs do that, or else everyone's familiar with networks and what they do. The other thing is a template. Well, I'll get into that. A template will be something with a number of parts connected together in a particular way. Okay, so, let me now start elaborating this point of template, which seems to be behind Alexa Yardley's thinking and seems to be extremely productive in what it can do.
Okay, well, let me say what's important about a template.
You use a template to sort of help you construct something. We had something recently at home, something which is used to assemble a thing which collects rainwater coming down the pipe, and that comes with a template. You stick this structure on your pipe, and you cut wherever lines are marked. So that's clearly a form, these lines, which are guiding an action. Okay, so that's roughly what a template is. And, let me go through some examples. DNA and RNA are examples because the Here you've got a collection, this string, which is a special kind of group, and the elements of that string are telling you something. Well, this comes in various forms. The RNA governs the proteins, and these proteins then do things. So it's a kind of template for doing things. It's, a useful way of thinking of it. Language is another kind of template. It's a string which guides an action, and in the case of language, it has a particular form which guides the actions corresponding to it. Okay, that's a template. Two important templates are cycles and the group and group operation. Cycle is something which goes through in a cycle, and if you have something which is intrinsically cyclic, like it goes through in a particular sequence, this can then guide other repeating actions. So this is a special kind of template at work.
Grouping and ungrouping, this is just one
thing, say splitting into two or going together, which you'll recall is the basic thing of the critical grouping. And that could pull two things apart. Supposing you have one thing attached to something and it is pulled apart, that could move something else apart. Equally, you could pull things together.
Okay, so this is starting to show what templates are here.
One particularly important example is replication. You could say DNA is made of two complementary strands, and you could say each is a template for the other. And then strand one assembles strand two. What it does is to collect complementary nucleotides until you get the chain. And these split,
and here's the general scheme. U sort of assembles V, then splits, and then V can assemble U, and so you replicated your original U.
Now, point and circular theory is that this might be a general thing.
I have examples. There's all sorts of cases
where one thing gives rise to a second thing, and this produces the first thing back again. So, for example, if a word and a corresponding action, the word generates the action, then the action generates the word again, if you have a system designed to do that. In fact, this is, one of these assembly processes. The whole point is that these are things which we know about in biology, but there's absolutely no reason why we should be confined to biology.
So they might be
universal. These patterns which we find in ordinary biology may happen at a more fundamental level. So this now raises the question, is biology the product of physics, which is what is usually assumed? Ordinary biology comes from physics and chemistry, and these in turn come from mathematics. So it's the mathematical strand. But there seems no reason why all these processes couldn't have their own biology. So there's a, as it were, a subtle form of life which is entirely these patterns. Now, some people suggest that, in fact, life occurs in all sorts of forms. Now, if I can remember this title of this symposium, maybe it'll come to me. But if you look at my lecture collection on the university video site, that's one of the ones which I can't remember the name of it now, but I suppose if you search for Hokkaido on the university site, the chances are you'll find that video. That's where it took place. The Hokkaido 8 symposium took place in the same place as G8 took place, so it was called the H8 symposium. Okay. So life might be much more universal. So maybe something more fundamental than biology and physics. Wheeler is saying observer participancy might be the basis of everything, whereas Yardley is saying essentially circling circles, which are the basis of everything. And of course you can't just say that it's the basis for everything, you have to say that there's this apparatus that we've been talking about, all these funny things happen, and that could be this other form of life. So, can I get this anywhere? Well, the thesis that I just described is saying biology is all pervasive, not just chemistry based. Now, let me see where this might get us. One thing is that particular forms dominate. Now, this is obvious in biology. There are things like replication, reproduction, feeding and so on, getting food for energy. All sorts of things are universal, or at least they're very widespread in the biological realm. You say when this system runs, if you let it run, assuming it's universal, then some things are going to predominate. The reason that these templates have useful results, a system which looks out for food is obviously going to survive better than a system that doesn't. Let's see if I got examples. I got them down here. Use of science. Well, I come to these later. These are the kind of things which you would expect to appear if you had everything going together at the subtle level. Incidentally, I hope I'm recording this. I'll put it on the website later. We need evolution. What's needed for evolution is, first of all, structures. So you assume there are structures, and these, some of these will be stable, but there can also be mutations. Has to be a mechanism which decides that something ought to change, makes it more likely to change, and then you can get a modification of the structure. You can even, Yardley makes the analogy with computers, that there can be bits, because you might have a bit of structure, a component of structure which can act like a bit. You may, for example, switch from one thing or split into two. That two can even have a continuously variable if it rotates. So you've got a lot of apparatus there which can, and especially if it can act like a computer in this way, could lead to evolution and hence much more complicated things. So it's all this mechanism by which simple cycling, the simpler thing she talks about is something, two things cycling around each other, but then you get complexes of each cycle. These could evolve. And certain things will evolve because they're important. One of these things is called semiosis. This is an idea of Peirce, and that is actually three things acting together: sign, object, and interpretant, which links them together. There's a particular way which Peirce analysed in detail, in which things can act as signs, and this all develops through habits. So this kind of system, as it evolves, you'd expect to become specialised, just as life gets specialised in particular things. One of these is this application of signs. Now, once you evolve to the point where there are signs, you can then get logic, for example. To get logic, you have, say, propositions which can be true or false, and then you want to combine these in ways which are representing true or false. So you can see things get gradually more elaborate. In fact, you could then build formal systems, including mathematics. Oh, okay, let me just go back here. One thing which Suzanne Langer, philosopher Suzanne Langer, pointed out in a book called Philosophy in a New Key is there are two kinds of symbols, ones that denote things and ones which act sort of internally. Science deals what wants to get things under control and say that this means that, so you have descriptions of reality. But aesthetics, art, involves a different application of symbol. So she says basically some symbols are power symbols, this sort of fits as this collaboration with former member of this college, Tempest Carpenter. Here is, if you want to see the paper we wrote at a conference on consciousness. Yes, this is capital KWCMS and then a little S, abbreviated form. But you can find it just by going to my home pages and following links, publications, music, just as well. Anyway, it turns out that this fits quite well. This was based on her musical knowledge of what themes do, what composers thought about themes. It fits quite nicely into this picture, so that's an additional plus. But I said, but there's, besides this, there are these formal systems which denote something. Well, then mathematical structures. Well, mathematics is a formal system. Once you've got a formal system, your life form might be able to use it to build mathematical structures. The way they could do it would be essentially trying to connect. Now, this is the connection theme. Make a, what he calls a circle, special group, linking an internal structure with an external structure. And once you've got that, you can impose, or try to impose, features on your external structures. In other words, make a mathematical form out of them. Okay, basically, this is a way Salz-Wheeler's problem shows how this circular theory can go through various stages, more and more complex structures, till you get universes. And since symmetry plays such a small, large role in conventional physics, one might, for example, speculate that these systems are applying symmetry. Incidentally, I give an example of application of symmetry, which is grinding of telescopes, that you the way you grind a telescope is you first telescope mirror is you first make a spherical mirror, and you do it by simply moving a mirror over a tool with some grinding material, and that turns it into a sphere. And the reason it's a sphere is because that's got a symmetry group associated with it. So these entities are sort of grinding out or shaping a universe of kind we observe in the same way. Okay, now let me just finish off by saying things about it. One of the things I'm interested in is intelligent design. Now, a thing that people may surprise people is there's a connection between Trinity and intelligent design, is that there's a Lord Mackay, who's an honorary fellow of Trinity, and he is very much connected with intelligent design. He's one of the people in charge of the Centre of Intelligent Design in Edinburgh, and he chaired a meeting, a lecture by this chap, Stephen Meyer, in London. He confirmed he was the same Lord Mackay, who was an honorary fellow of Trinity. And the trouble with intelligent design is that people won't accept that it's a scientific process. Now, Stephen Meyer, I should say, has an impeccable background. He has a PhD in philosophy from Cambridge University. And he has a very rigorous treatment of it, essentially analyzing the cell and saying it seems a bit inexplicable. Anyway, he treats it in a very proper philosophical way, and as his book, Signature of the Cell, goes into detail. And I think also his lecture is on YouTube. Okay, however, this has become politicized. People insist that there's a connection with the, the standard creationism, and that this is just creationism in disguise. Well, I can show you it's clearly not. A lot of scientists have come to a view that this is that you need postulating intelligence as a thing, and one of Meyer's points is we don't mind intelligence in one context, namely human beings, so what is wrong with postulating intelligence elsewhere if it helps you understand biology? And you can say this is God, or you don't have to. Treat it as a scientific enterprise and see where it gets you. Now, I don't think very much intelligent design people haven't done very much on the question of what is intelligence, but this kind of theory would sort of close the gap by allowing it to connect with, by providing a model of intelligence.
So, as I say, it's got entirely political, very heated. People won't accept, won't view it as a scientific enterprise. There's another YouTube video, which is somewhat over the top, called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. Somebody investigated what happened to people who dared do things like I'm doing, saying intelligence design might be, there might be something to it. They lost their jobs or something. It's pretty that while this was going on, pictures of what happens in what the Nazis did, I mean, which I don't think helps. Anyway, that's called intelligence. Expelled, no intelligence allowed. Politics has also interfered with the project, I'm afraid. There was a project. The point of this is you might say, well, how can you make this more rigorous? One answer is to do computer modelling. Well, I did have a student begin computer modelling back in 1995, a namesake of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. If you search for George Osborne Cogprince, I think the Chancellor of the Exchequer hasn't published anything on Cogprince, so that'll get you to his paper. So he actually did a computer model which was somewhat similar to this. It was based on an idea of a mathematician called hyperstructures. So he got a computer simulation which showed that this worked, so showed hyperstructures could be a valid idea, learnt a skill. And then it encountered people who couldn't understand the mathematics and said this is not a good project, and it was blocked. I took the opportunity to write something about this. We have till 6:30, I think, so we're doing quite well. I'll say that in a minute. There's also a video when progress and politics collide, which is actually a clip from a lecture of mine. One of the editors of a Russian language journal, Low Temperature Physics, which is translated into English, asked if I'd like to write something to celebrate 50 years since the first paper on the junction. So I said, maybe, will you censor what I write? And he said, no, we won't. True to their word, they let me have a section when progress and politics collide, which is about all this. Okay, that's more or less what I said. I just mentioned this strange collaboration. Alexa wrote to me a few years ago saying, I have some ideas you might be interested in. They sounded pretty crazy, but also intriguing. So what seems to be is that she has a kind of picture of things circling and interacting in certain ways, and it's something which is really hard to describe. She couldn't really describe it, but just say things. And so I've gradually been finding out that you can explain them in scientific terms and putting together this theory. So I think I'll close there. Thank you very much.